All right, it is, well, almost the end of 2013. It is December 30th, 2013. And we're sitting here on a cold, gray day outside, but ready for some good stuff inside. I'm talking with Louisville radio legend, I can say that now, Terry Miners. Hey, Terry, how you doing, man?
Jack, it is a pleasure to sit down with you to talk about our favorite subject, broadcasting. Yeah. Well, one of many. We have families we love, but we love broadcasting.
Hit a golf ball together. Well, not together.
Right.
We hit a golf ball. And
once or twice.
In the same woods for them at some time or other. Hey, Terry, you come from, let's talk about you for just a minute. You come from an interesting family. The Miners family is known throughout Louisville for years now. Let's talk about where you came from and neighborhoods and dad and mom and all that stuff and brothers. And how many were in your family?
I am one of 14. I am number 5 of 7 boys and 7 girls born to Mel and Norma Miners, and they're both from Germantown growing up. And we lived there until I was 7, and then we moved about a mile and a half away over by Audubon Park. And I thought it was a completely different world.
Really?
But being at number 5 in the midst of all those people, you learn to do things to stand out.
Okay, yeah.
And one of the things that I did when I was a kid was impersonate people like Bill Bailey, who was the morning legend on WHAS radio. Oh, my dad would get a kick out of that. Yeah, exactly, WAKY radio. And my dad would just get a big kick out of it, and I'd say, "Good morning, Reed Jaden's here with the news," and he'd do all that, and my dad just thought that was so great.
And that's where all this started, really, sort of?
Did
you do other people, and family members?
But I liked doing Bill Bailey's voice because he was so prominent there on Wacky Radio. He was also on WKLO at one point. I can't remember if he was on prior to Wacky, but he was a Louisville legend, and I was a little kid, and I know my dad enjoyed listening to him. So I guess it was a means of getting my dad's attention in the midst of all those siblings, was to say, oh, my dad likes that guy on the radio. I can get more of my dad's FaceTime if I impersonate him.
How about that? Now, this was when?
The 1970s. Mm-hmm. I was born in 1957, so I remember, like, to the late 60s, I think Bill Bailey was on the radio then. So that must have been when that started.
Yeah, how about that? Now, I think I heard you say some time ago that you developed your humor also because with as many people around the dinner table, you only had 30 seconds to make your mark or something. So it had to be quick and funny. And
correct. What we did is, my mom is really a funny person. She encouraged all of us to try to tell a joke before dessert.
Oh, really?
If you heard something funny that day, some levity that was in your life, to share that with everybody at the table before we had dessert. And so a lot of people just turned that into a joke. You know, knock, knock, who's there? You know, whatever.
Yeah.
They just wanted to get the piece of pie.
Right.
So yeah, no, there were a lot of extroverts in our family in that sense that they felt at least compelled to be a little bit show busy and just to get a treat.
Anybody else in entertainment or show business?
None, zero. One, huh? Most of my brothers and sisters own their own companies. I'm the only idiot with a job, is the way I always put that. I'm the person answering to some, some boss somewhere. But I have a lot of strong, independent brothers and sisters. But none of them shy away from telling a joke. I think that's where that comes from.
Well, now, your dad was kind of an outgoing guy. Mel Miners was all known throughout there. What he did,
right.
A milkman and
he was
a
milkman. He was a wrestler before he got married. My mother made him quit right after a year or so. He got called back in, like, when my oldest brother was 2 or something. He was asked to be in some sort of exhibition in Cleveland. And my mother loves telling the story of my oldest brother. He's a little kid. He's sitting there. And my mom said, we didn't have any money. But my brother said he was sworn to secrecy, that he was not allowed to tell my dad's identity because my dad had to wear a mask when he was in this wrestling thing in Cleveland. And my brother asked my mom, can we get some popcorn and soda pop? My mom said, we don't have any money or whatever. You know, I'd rather not do that. And my brother looked at my mom, the little kid looked up, and he said, if you don't get me that popcorn, I'll tell everybody who he is. I'll tell Dad's identity, however he said it. He was a wheeler dealer from the beginning.
That's right.
My dad was kind of like Norm on Cheers. When we walked into the grocery store or in church, people would call out, hey, Mel. It was like the norm character. Yeah, he was a great big guy, 6'4", probably 300 pounds at one time. Mm-hmm. And just well-known and gregarious and liked to hug people, put his arms around people and talk to them. And it didn't really dawn on me until later, probably in my, 10, 11, 12-year-old stage, that occasionally I may go to a store with some other kid and his dad, and people didn't holler out for his dad.
Isn't that interesting?
And it was the first time I thought, wow, my dad's different.
Yeah. Huh.
It was just interesting. And I've noticed, too, over the years that many of my siblings are the same way. They're touchers. They hug people. Mm-hmm. Big, boisterous laughs. And I guess we got that from our dad. I know I'm certainly that way.
How about that? Well, now, you're kind of a rarity here that you are a prominent Louisvillian, but your whole life's been spent here.
You
went to college for a short while in UK, but you're a Louisville. Where'd you go to grade school and high school and all that stuff?
St. Stephen Martyr's where we moved. When I told you we moved out of Germantown, I was at St. Elizabeth for 1 year, and then St. Stephen Martyr, then really 7-8 blocks away is St. X High School, so I was able to run to high school every day.
Right in the same neighborhood.
Yeah. And then I went to the St. University of Kentucky. And wait a minute. That was interesting, too. Going to college was the first time I was not in a Catholic school, and there was no structure. And I remember, like, the first or second day of college, it's August, so it's hot. And I remember walking to class, and a guy came in and sat down in a classroom next to me, and he wasn't wearing a shirt. And all I could think was, my Lord, if a nun saw a guy like this. And he's just sitting there. Yeah, and he slouched down in his chair, and I thought, wow, this guy's going to get corked in a minute. But of course, that never happened. It was college.
That's wild. Now, that's where your radio career began, wasn't it, in college?
Yes.
Was it in your mind before, from the Bill Bailey thing? Had you wanted to be in radio?
I did. I would impersonate Bill Bailey in our bedroom. My brothers would laugh at me. I'd play my little 45s on a record player, and then the record would fade out, and I'd say, good morning, I'm Bill Bailey, and do all that stuff. My brothers thought that was hilarious. While I was still at St. X, I got a chance to go down to Wacky Radio and hang around a little bit.
Oh, really?
Because of Coyote Calhoun. Yeah. I met him at St. X. He came and spoke there once, and I said, I like broadcasting. And also at St. X, I ran their little TV station.
Okay.
So I put shows on. So I had my hands on already in high school a little bit. But you're right, when I went away to college at Kentucky, I took classes oriented that way, but I'd just gotten a job at a local radio station in Lexington, just hanging tapes on an automated station. Hmm. So I knew a little bit about
foot in the door, though.
Yes, to my technical knowledge was there. A guy who used to work at KLO was at WKQQ as a program director, and he let me work on the weekend overnights. But I would go to class during the day and hear the professor up there talking about radio, and I thought, you haven't been out of this room in 20 years, because what he was talking about was so far away from where we were. He was taught a certain way, and then it was all changing because there was automated radio, which means they just ran songs, and I had to change the reels on them, and then ultimately that station went live, and I got a chance to get on.
Huh. Now, you remember that? You remember it's your first job there?
Oh, yeah.
And it was... But were you a disc jockey? Were you doing the funny stuff then, or just doing it straight, or playing it straight?
What they let me do, it was album-oriented rock, and it was a cool station. And they were transitioning it to a live station. And they let me come on one time in the middle of the night to announce the time change. And it sounded something like this. It's 2 o'clock. But it's 1 o'clock. But really, it's 2 o'clock. But here's Led Zeppelin, and then I just wanted to turn on the microphone and say something, and it was so exciting to get to do that because the program director gave me permission to do that, and so occasionally he would let me just try things on the overnight show just to practice.
Wow.
Talking into the mic because, who's up?
Yeah, right. And it's a whole different when you actually turn that mic on. It's different.
Exactly right.
Than doing it in your bedroom and impersonating Bill.
Right. Bill, and the real job, though, was to make sure that those tapes stayed up on those machines, because when they ran out, you ran out of music. And the tape, it was automated so that five different tape decks would pop on at different times and play songs in a row. And then you had to have some guy there, me, the college boy with minimum wage, to change the tapes.
Now, isn't it interesting? Because today we're all computer-oriented to do that, but that was cutting edge back then.
That was in the 70s, right. And then they went live and they got rid of the automation. They put real DJs on, and one of them didn't work out. And so I was still on the weekends to, you know, do some sort of technical stuff. And then they gave me a shot. And when I got on, I started, you know, the usual basic announcing, just as short as I could. And then I started using sound effects. I was always fascinated by that. And so I would say, pretend like, all right, I'm going to play Lynyrd Skynyrd, but this boss is on my back about cutting the grass around the tower again. It's my week to do that. And then you'd hear a lawnmower. Broom, broom, broom. And then it would start up, and I'd say, I'll be back. And then I would fade that sound effect out, and the music would come up. And then as the song faded down, 6 minutes later, you'd hear the lawnmower. And then I'd act like I was out of breath. You know, there was somebody threw a pile of garbage in the backyard, and I shot it out, and a bunch of beer cans hit me in the head or whatever.
Yeah.
And then I just started playing
around.
Did you
get a reaction to that? That was different.
Mostly from my boss, who said, stop doing that. But I just wanted to experiment and see what that felt like.
I
take a sound effect of a guy chopping wood and say, it was a cold day and the fire's about to die. Chop, chop. You know, and do that. And then,
that's very creative, yeah.
But I just was using that theater of the mind that I'd probably seen in movies and wanted to try that a little bit.
Anybody else on the station doing that?
No.
No, not at all.
No, it set me apart from them. Yeah. They just thought I was a little weird. But but otherwise, you played three songs in a row without talking.
Yeah,
and so it was one of those album rock stations where it was really, they just wanted minimal input from the human.
Yeah. And you were adding to that a little bit. How long were you there at that station?
4 years. And this
all the time during college then?
Yes. And Jack, let me tell you, this is the funny part. I just got tired of it. I thought I was stuck in the mud and whatever I was making was never going to change. And my brother owned a convenience store in Indianapolis, and he said, why don't you try? Come up here with me and just try running this for a while. I said, great, I need a break from this. I just don't like it anymore.
Is that right?
So I was up there about 3 months, and man, people were stealing from us, and somebody stole a case of cigarettes. Not a carton, a case of cigarettes. So I don't know what that was worth, hundreds of dollars, whatever it was. It was the same amount as what a car cost at that time. And I was just sick because I couldn't manage all this. People, they were just pulling all kinds of tricks on me, and so I started calling around to Louisville radio stations to get back in radio.
You found a convenience store wasn't your bag. So.
Correct. I was not good at this.
So you just called stations?
I called some of the people because I had some connections from Lexington days. So Mrs. Henson, Louisa Henson at WLRS, hired me, and I said, their only stipulation is I don't want to be on the air anymore. I've done that enough.
Really?
So I was hired to be their promotions director. And I loved it. And LRS is a very cool station, and it's 1980 at this time.
Well, the Hensons were pioneers, in Louisville broadcasting.
Great people, just wonderful to me, and they sort of rescued me from my convenience store, purgatory, where I was. that was a good lesson learned. And then eventually, the evening girl would be sick, or the afternoon guy wasn't there, and they'd say, Terry, you know how to get in there. We need to do the afternoon show or do the evenings. And I'd go in and fill in for someone.
And that's how that started.
And then the morning guy, Dan Burgess, left to go to HAS. He was partnered with Ron Clay. And they thought, why don't we try you in there with Ron? He needs a partner in there.
That's how that began.
That's how it all started.
Wow, and that's a legend in Louisville radio. Now, anybody a certain age, especially, you mentioned Terry Mighty, said bring up Ron Clay.
What was
Ron Clay like? He was an interesting guy.
He was the sweetest person. And he was 7 years older than I, and we really came from different kind of walks of life. He had already been in the military, and he was like the hippie who was soured on life. He had just had enough.
Lieutenant Dan.
Exactly. He was just the kindest person, but he just was mellow and he wanted to be left alone by society. And he loved, talking on the radio, and he was funny in this really dry, wry way. He was hilarious. And then I was the preppy boy wearing the ties and the Catholic school background. So the two of us put together made for a real nice oil and water, mix. They didn't fully mix, but we were great at finishing each other's sentences.
How long did it take that chemistry? Was that immediate?
Almost immediate.
Is that right?
And that's the thing is, you never know how a team can work out, but when personalities are built a certain way, I guess, just like trying to find a piece to go on an engine, it's not the original piece, but it still cranks down on there.
Yeah.
And that worked. And so we were able to sort of finish each other's sentences. And then when something would get to be a little edgy in his realm, he would do that. And I would pretend to be, oh, flustered by it. And that sort of worked. It was all show business nonsense. Yeah. Of course, we were both smart enough to know what was going on there. But Ron was really savvy about creativity on the air. And he taught me a lot of things about challenging authority, which is something that was...
You would never do.
Certainly not acceptable in my life. No. For instance, we'd call the White House. Call the White House. I mean, can you imagine that today? Today, they'd send in a drone and blast you. But Ron would pick up the phone and call the White House in D.C. and say, let me speak to President Reagan. Just tell him it's the show with no name, guys. Tell him it's morning sickness team. And the lady would say, what? He said, he knows us. Ron would say, he knows us. Ron and Terry. You know, and oh, my. It just created pandemonium. Wow.
Yeah, you had a lot of memorable bits over there.
Yes.
You guys did some great
things. We were great compliments to each other in that, you know, we could fill different realms of comedy and do sounds and do silly voices. And then we just made up things, a lot of it on the fly. And Ron was just very, very creative. And it was a fun thing to do. So we were there for a couple of years on WLRS. So naturally, you know what happens. The competition gets tired of hearing about us.
Yeah.
They call me. Ron was not a business guy. He loved the on-air and the creativity, but when the show was over...
it didn't matter. So
When the show was over, he'd go out the door. He wasn't interested in doing any production for the next day or anything. Just that wasn't his thing. Wow. He was just a hang-loose guy. And so WQMF is another rock station in town. They've been on a couple of years, and they're marginally successful, but they can't get around this morning team on WLRS. Morning Sickness is the name. And Ron and I are very successful. So they call me, and I think we were making $25,000 a year. I'd been kicked up to $25,000 from 18, which was a significant change, clearly. Not too long before, because they thought, you know, this show's getting more valuable. I have no idea what Ron was making. Anyway, QMF calls, and the guy says...
What year was this?
This is the end of 1982.
Okay.
It goes on for... a week or so, 10 days of talking. He said, how about $32,000 each? I was like, well, I was making 18 a couple of weeks ago. Now I'm making 25, and now I'm about ready to double my money. How fast can I get there? I mean, that's the way that...
Sure, yeah.
So I called Ron. I'm 28 at the time,
So
he's 35. And I called Ron. He goes, whatever you think's right. I mean, he just...
Is that right?
I mean... You know, we loved the Hensons. They were great to us, but, you know, he had three kids. And
was he a Louisville guy?
He was from Binghamton, New York.
Okay.
And I wasn't married, but he, you know, Ron had a family to take care of. And, I mean, that was, a significant raise for him, because I know my pay had gone up significantly. Anyway, we meet at the Bristol Bar and Grill right around this time of year, right at the end of 1982, last week of the year. And we're sitting there having dinner in the front window at the Bristol on Bardstown Road with John Otting, who owns QMF. And then in walks one of the owners of WLRS.
Oh, my goodness.
Who's Lee Masters, who's a great guy, but he's a partner with the Hensons.
Yeah.
He looks over. He sees his morning team sitting with the competition ownership.
Knows, yeah.
Yes, right away. And John Otting stands up and he says, hello, Lee. I think you know Ron and Terry.
Oh,
that's what he said. And we just sat there and went, hey. I mean, it was weird. And they already had contracts drawn up and that I had already had approved from a lawyer. So we had already moved that far along and the papers were out. And that's all he said. And then Lee Masters went on to another part of the restaurant. But we knew. And then we finished our dinner and John Otting said, if I were you, I'd go get your stuff out of the station. And you start tomorrow morning on QMF.
Wow.
So we go down to the station. Lee Masters has called his partners, and Louisa Henson is waiting there at the station. And we walk in, or I walk in. Ron hadn't come yet. I went there straight from the dinner. And she's standing in a doorway with her arms up high, touching either side of the door, and her legs down, touching the corners of the doorway. And she said, go past me. Don't go. And I said, all I want to do is get my stuff. And she just said, if you touch me, you're not allowed to touch me.
Wow.
She was very serious about it. She just said, we're going to work this out. Don't, I said, but I just want to get my personal effects. And she said, no, we're gonna go to court and work this out. And ultimately, Lee Masters showed up and he said, let them have their stuff.
Wow.
So I let him have him stuff. So I went in and got my things. And I don't know how Ron cleared his out later, but I took all my things out of my little area that I had there and walked out. And that was the end of it.
That was it. Wow.
I went home and it's, let's say, 9 o'clock at night. A man pulls up in front of my house. I'm living in a duplex. And he's sitting out there. And this is the early days of what we called car phones.
Oh, yes.
Car phones. Ring, ring. My girlfriend was there with me. Is Terry there? She said, no, he's not. He called 10 minutes later. Is Terry there? No, he's not. He's waiting to serve a subpoena. They got a judge to sign a cease and desist or something.
So
I knew.
So you couldn't go on the air.
Correct. Yeah. They got the game in motion right away.
Wow.
Well, Ron lived in Indiana, so he wasn't subject to the same situation. And they didn't know where to find him. So this guy just stayed parked in front of this house, and he would call every so often. And then we quit answering the phone. But we're in a duplex. So I call the girl who lives downstairs. Can I use your car? And, oh, yeah, she loved being a part of it. So I went down the back steps at 4 a.m. or whatever, and she gave me her keys. And I went out, took her car out of the back, and drove over to QMF over in southern Indiana. Got on
oh
the air. Ron was already there.
That's how it started.
So wow. We got on the air and we pretended this whole war format takeover. We kicked in the door and threw the regular QMF morning man off the air and said, it's a takeover. It's a coup.
Now, when did that occur to you? On the way in that morning or something?
We talked about it, at that dinner.
Wow.
And then so we did it the next morning. And it was a takeover. And I mean, of course, all the TV stations show up and then the newspapers there.
What publicity. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it was complete insanity that morning. And then after a couple of hours, they taped a cease and desist order from the court onto the glass, which technically really didn't matter because we were in Indiana and it was a Jefferson yeah. County, Kentucky district judge, circuit judge who signed it. It was irrelevant over there.
Yeah. Uh-huh.
But they finally, the QMF people came in and said, we think we've milked this cow long enough now. You guys come on in off the air. And then we had to go to court that day.
Oh, my gosh.
So, yeah, they had hired Wyatt Tarrant Combs to defend us that day. And they went to court. And the judge went through everything. And WLRS made their case and said, we have a verbal agreement. And we said, no, you don't. You know, we don't have any verbal agreement. And we've signed this agreement with QMF. So the judge took an hour or two and he came back and he said, I'm going to let you boys switch stations, but you cannot use the names of the sketches or the name of the show. Those remain the intellectual property of WLRS. So Morning Sickness, we had to give up and the names of any of the sketches. So that's why we called our new show, The Show with No Name.
Oh,
it was taken away by law. And we started and we did that whole media war thing and it was hilarious and got us a great springboard and we never looked back.
It's a significant part of Louisville radio lore. I mean,
right.
Really, yeah, that's amazing.
It was fun.
What about your sketches? Did you create new sketches or give them new names?
No, we gave them new names. Celebrity Death Watch became Celebrity Death Race or something like that. You know, they were just alterations on things that were already there.
Did you have people at LRS who were part of your skits, did voices for you or anything? Did they come over or did you have to create new things or were they all just you and Ron?
They were mostly us. You know, we had a few people over there. And of course, we didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings at WLRS. We love our coworkers. But it was just a matter of, like I told you, almost doubling my pay in a matter of a month.
Sure.
And who wouldn't do that?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a thing you love. And of course, you and I both know from being in this business, publicity is good. And that gave us an enormous amount of publicity because then all the TV stations were yapping about us for several days and following us to see what would happen.
You made a lot of progress in a radio career in a very short amount of time,
right.
Really, from starting from a guy who's switching tapes to
right.
know, this kind of publicity. That's amazing in, what, and three, 4 years?
And
there,
getting
right?
robbed in a convenience
right,
store.
Yeah. Big jump. Big jump. When I hear you were QMF for and you're having good success, this was 1982 then? Or 83?
Right at the beginning of 83.
83. Well, in 1985, you came to WHAS.
I did.
But that had to start in 1984 sometime. How did that all come about? What was going on there?
It was actually in 1985, in the winter of 85, a salesperson from HAS called me and said, the afternoon show is going to come open on HAS. If I were you, I would apply. I thought, well, that's an interesting note. So I thought, I'm 28 years old. I like doing this teen thing, but I want to go to a grown-up station. I would much prefer to be on a grown-up station. Bill Cody was apparently leaving HAS Radio to go to Nashville, maybe. I think that's where he was
going. Actually, he was going, I think he was going to WKLO Radio. I think he was going across. I may be wrong about
that. Or CII?
That. Yeah, CII. Yeah, he went over to the country station,
for a where he was leaving? Yeah, okay, before he went to Nashville.
Yeah.
And then you came in and started doing afternoons until they were going to fill that.
Yeah, I started in January of 85. So, and you, because you had a contract obligation.
I did.
You couldn't come on the air for.
I was contractually bound to QMF on a three-year deal, but.
Well, that's right, because I started, Bill left, and I started in January. They didn't start talking to you till the spring of 85.
Correct.
So, and you couldn't come on the air till like December. Or
correct,
something,
exactly right. So maybe let's say April, I first heard out of somebody at HAS.
So how did, were you surprised at that?
Yes, very much so. But the person I knew who was in sales at HAS was a friend of mine. And when he said, that's the way he said it. If I were you, I would apply.
Hmm.
And I thought, well, that's code.
And
what it turned out to be is HAS didn't want to infringe on my contract. So they just had somebody float a trial balloon, kind of saying, would you be interested?
Yeah.
So I immediately went and wrote a letter, 84 reasons why you should hire Terry Miners. And then I just thought of 84 different things.
Yeah.
And I sent him over to Denny Nugent, who was a program director. And he later told me, he said, as soon as I opened that and read that, he said, I knew I was going to hire you.
Denny was a sharp guy, really, and a good programmer, very good programmer.
And he talked to me a lot about listening to us on QMF and listening to what we did and our contributions. And he thought, I can tell that guy would be great for us.
That'd be a good transition for
you. Yes. Huh. And it worked out nicely.
So
it was sad, the departing of QMF. I didn't want to do it because it felt weird, but I knew it was the best thing for my career. And I had the same lawyer who wrote the initial thing to go to QMF write a letter of departure. And he wrote essentially this, according to the terms of the contract, Terry Miners wants to leave starting immediately. He will stay here another 6 months to help you transition in a new partner for the morning show that he is leaving. But his non-compete starts ticking immediately. So I had that all written up, and I got off work on that Friday, and Ron was off that week, so I was by myself. The show was over. I walk into John Otting, the general manager, station manager, and owner of QMF, and he always treated me very well. And I said, can I see you for a minute? And he said, yes. And I handed him the letter, and he read it. He's sitting at his desk, and he read it. And then he looked up at me standing there in front of him, and he looked back down, and he read it again. And then without saying anything else, he just looked at me, and he said, I think you better leave. Well, he had kind of an explosive personality and could really scream and holler and get wild with people, but he never treated me that way the whole time I was there.
Isn't that interesting?
From 83 to here it is, middle of 85.
Yeah.
And he did not blow a gasket like I thought he would, but they told me later it was pretty upset with me.
Sure.
Well, by the time I got my stuff, I was allowed to get my stuff.
Didn't stand at the doorway.
Yeah, no. And then I left and drove home, and when I got home, my phone was ringing, and it was Bo Wood in Cincinnati, and he owned WEBN and part of QMF. He was partners with John Otting and QMF. And the phone's ringing, and I pick it up, and he said, come on. He said, what are you doing? He said, all HAS is trying to do is hurt us. We've got momentum in this market. We're doing very well, and they're just trying to break it up. And he said, all they're going to do is sign you to a deal and then fire you in 2 months just to break up what they've got going.
Well, for one thing, that's a big departure for WHAS.
Right.
That's
what he said. Yeah, right. He said, they don't want you on their station. You don't belong on there. You belong on a rock station where you are. And he said, I'll tell you what. Over this 6 month no compete, why don't you come up here to Cincinnati, co-host the morning show with my sister. She does the mornings on WEBN. Robin Wood is her name. She used to do them back then. And he said, you can just co-host with her and we'll talk this thing through. And I thought about it. I thought, wow, I love EBN. I'd love that chance, but no thanks. And I told him no.
Wow.
And so this is the end of May. It's right around Memorial Day weekend. I think it was the Friday going into Memorial Day weekend. And HAS had pretty much told me quietly through some surrogate, just lay low for a month. Just don't do anything for a month. That weekend's also the weekend where the Sunday magazine came out and Ron Clay and I were on the cover. Mm-hmm. And they had already written that story and it was already in the bank and I knew it was coming out, but I had to wait until that. So that was another big boost for our career. And then later they had to announce I was gone. But what HAS did that was smart is they had me come in on July, 1st of July of 85, fill out all my paperwork. And they thought, well, you can't be on the air until December 1st since you quit at the beginning of the end of May, 1st of June. You can't be on until December 1. So why don't we have the other guys on the station talk about you? And then once a week, you go out and work some listener's job and give them the day off with pay. So I would go out and say, work at a bakery or work at a loading dock or work at a department store. And whoever's place I was taking, the person who sent in a card or whatever and said, I want Terry to work for me, they got their day off work but still got paid. And I went in. And then all the guys on HAS could talk about, here's what Terry's doing today.
Yeah, yeah.
You remember that?
Yeah, I do. I remember very well, yeah.
And that's how
that
they...
It had to be an interesting time for you, though, to go from all those creative juices
right.
stuff to, for 6 months. What did you do?
It was unsettling because I was afraid I would lose my mojo.
Yeah, right, yeah. And you were not with Ron anymore. You
correct.
Were by yourself,
I was on my own, yeah. And then I was afraid I was going to lose that creativity that we'd had churning every day. And it was a little unnerving.
I can't remember. Did you go into the studio and produce bits or anything?
Yes.
I thought you had to... I
spent
that.
Time... Mm-hmm. writing intros, and then I worked with a guy named Randy Davidson, who's a brilliant impressionist, and he was already working there at HAS mm-hmm. and AMZ,
yeah.
And he and I invented together a character named Buzz Baxter, who was the fake announcer, but it was based on like Don Pardo from Saturday Night Live, that kind of a delivery.
Yeah.
We made him a big mama's boy. He lived with his mother. His mother would take the daily newspaper and clip out the stories she didn't want him to know. And he would always say, I have to run that by mother, Ted. Yeah. And one of the things he would say on one of our intros was, this show my mother is hating, she says Terry Miners is Satan.
I remember that very well, yeah.
It was fun writing that kind of stuff, and it helped me stay creative through those months. So I wrote a lot of intros for pieces.
Had to create new characters.
Right. Yeah. And Buzz Baxter was brand new. And there were several new characters that we were able to...
Paco Bell. Remember
Paco Bell wasn't just made up. That was just a made up thing I could use because I didn't have a partner anymore. Yeah. I needed someone to bounce things off of just for the nature of what I was used to doing.
Paco couldn't talk to you.
Paco couldn't talk.
Why?
He was an illegal immigrant. He had come over the fence near El Paso, Texas and got his tongue caught on the barbed wire. He couldn't talk, so he only spoke to me via chalkboard.
And you hear the scratching.
Yeah, you would hear the chalkboard. And I'd say, what are we going to do next? Play that Sinatra parody or whatever. Oh, yeah. But it gave me, while the scratching sound was on the air, it gave me a chance to collect a thought.
Yeah, yeah.
And so that was a good little...
Interesting, yeah.
Comedic tool that I'm sure people have used a zillion times in some capacity, but it gives you a pause... So that you can collect the thought. And then the listener waits to hear what the guy's writing on the board. It was pretty smart.
It was.
Turned out in retrospect.
By the way, did you study comedy or anything? Was there anybody that inspired you or anything?
No, but I loved watching guys on TV with my dad again.
Yeah.
The roast, the Dean Martin roasts, or shows like Carol Burnett, Jackie Gleason. Anywhere where someone would do stand-up or sketch comedy, I thought was... phenomenal.
Now, I'm trying to think of some of the other characters. Of course, you had the Beesman.
The Beesman has always been on.
Joby Hall.
You have to because there's such a passion for basketball in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. You have to have a Beesman character.
Well, Denny Crum. You did.
Yeah, Denny Crum. Randy did that voice. Hello, folks. I'm Denny Crum calling you on my complimentary cell phone from inside my complimentary Cadillac where I'm wearing complimentary clothes from Joseph A. Banks or whatever it was. And Howard Schnellenberger.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
I just spoke with him a couple of days ago. He's doing great.
But he got a lot of publicity with the athletic boy. And he
exactly
very
right.
Well, yeah.
And he, I would run my voice through a harmonizer. Disc jockey, you no good, poor excuse for a man. But I would always pretend like he was driving his big Cadillac up to the windows, but he didn't know how to drive very well. So I'd say, no, don't. and you'd hear the car crash through the glass. And then he'd get out and he'd, bend that bald head over here, you sissy. And then you'd hear a match striking sound, and then finally the match would light, and he'd light his pipe. And then he'd pick me up by the ankles and dunk my head in the toilet and tell me to do 5 push-ups and what a poor excuse for a man I am and all that.
That was great stuff, yeah. You had the Trouble Man.
The Trouble Man is a character from National Lampoon. They had a radio hour, and they had the Trouble Man. And I just, that was like an Ann Landers sort of a thing. But there's a big tough guy.
Does your voice again run through the synthesizer? You do most of your voice?
I do a lot of them. I don't do many anymore because my vocal cords are shot.
I'll be darned. Huh. Mm-hmm. All those years of doing those things, huh?
That's exactly right. I used to do Joe Dean's voice and Dick Vitale. Yeah. And they all require a lot of, hey, baby!
Yeah.
And but so it, much pumping it, and now I can't do them anymore.
That's interesting. Well, now, you were also very good at including people you worked with. Milton Metz, Van Vance, people like that, Wayne Perkey. I mean, you did a lot of things with those kind of real characters. And
it was easy to do. I made our building 84 stories high and then ran an elevator sound effect. And then I would just say, I'm going to go to the human resources department. But it wasn't really about going to the human resources department. It was to let people hear the different floor names.
Yeah.
And I just say, oh, man, I'm so tired. I stayed up and watched that Philadelphia Eagles game last night. Ding! 44th floor, Kaywood Ledford, Wildcat Museum. And then you'd hear people arguing, UK and U of L Peace Therapy Center, or whatever. And then the door would close, and then I'd start talking about something else again. But it was really just to use different floor.
Those ideas just come to you in the middle of the night?
Yes. I used to leave pads around and write them down. I used to write them down now. And I milked the elevator cow a lot. I liked it because it was just fun, because what I did is I took about 5 different cartridges that we use different ways to deliver sound now, but we had 8 different machines in there. And 5 of them would be different floors. So that way I never knew what floor was coming up next.
So you had to make it up.
It'd be the 44th floor, then the 13th floor, then the 66th floor, and then the 9th floor. It never made any sense, but that was the beauty of it.
Didn't make any difference, is it right?
Yeah.
Wow. Now, you just mentioned something about changes. At that time, you were in the building on Chestnut Street, 520 West Chestnut. You were there for several years.
Right.
Physically, was that a challenge for you? I mean, you ran your own board and everything then, didn't you?
I did.
I've had a lot of bits to do with cartridges then, before computers and everything.
But I like managing my own sound. I still do, to a great extent, manage my own bits and music. And now I have a producer who runs the commercials. I used to run those too.
Yeah, yeah.
Who runs the commercials and the various promos and things. I don't fool with that anymore. But the downtown building was phenomenal.
We were in with WHS television also, and that was nice because you could use the television people too.
Right. And we impersonated a lot of the TV people. I just had a nice conversation on TV a few days ago with Frank Hudson, who used to be a news anchor there, and Randy would lampoon him. I'm Frank Hudson. It's a lot like Ron Burgundy. I'm Frank Hudson, news stud, a real live anchorman. And then I had 2 women who worked in the office call themselves the Newslisses, because we had 2 newscasters named Melissa.
Oh, yeah. Melissa Forsythe
and
Melissa
Swan.
Melissa Swan, yeah.
So they would say, we're the Newslisses, but they would speak in unison, but they would crack on each other because, like, they were jealous of each other. We're the Newslisses. If this topic's about football, talk to her. She knows all about pigskin. Something like that.
That was great. Good stuff.
And Frank Hudson, his name just came up again because of this Anchorman 2 movie that came out. Mm-hmm. And he now works in Pennsylvania. He's out of broadcasting, but he was not happy when we'd have Randy say things like, hello, ladies. I'll be hosting the news tonight bare-chested in front of a fireplace stretched out on a bearskin rug. There'll be 2 champagne glasses, one for me and one for you to imagine belongs to you.
That sounds like Patrick. Who's your other character?
Patrick O'Neill.
Patrick O'Neill.
Now, he's still on. We have another voice guy who does that.
Yeah, I hear him now. Yeah.
He's on today, as a matter of fact. I wrote a sketch for him today and the Beesman today.
Don't you know who I am?
Don't you know who I am? He's a faded Hollywood star, and he's looking for liquor for New Year's Eve. And he also, because UPS had trouble delivering packages here over Christmas, He's still looking. He ordered a box of prostitutes from Nevada, and he doesn't know where they are. They're in a refrigerator box, and Patrick's waiting for them.
Is this still fun for you? I mean, to do this?
I love it every day.
Yeah.
I wake up every day and laugh about life. I mean, to me, it is an attitudinal thing. Rick Pitino taught me a lesson several years ago.
You've become very close with him over the years.
Yeah,
you?
He's been great. Pitino and I, he came in 89. So like 91, he had his assistant, his sports information director, call me because he'd heard about the parodies we do. And then we would do, I'm Oscar Combs and I'm Dave Baker on a UK Cat Calls call-in show. Mm-hmm. You know, hey, I'm Oscar Combs, and we're going to talk Wildcat basketball. And then Dave Baker is always a sycophantic kind of a guy. I love the Cats. The Cats are great. The Cats are going to do this, and the Cats are perfect. And so I bounce both of those voices back and forth. And then they would take calls from listeners who were Wildcat fans. Hey, this is Zach White from Pikeville. What time's the game tonight? Is Richie Farmer going to play tonight? I'll hang up and listen to your answer. They always say, I'll hang up and listen to your answer. Anyway, Pitino had heard about these things, and he asked for a tape of them. And so I made a cassette tape recording and sent it over to Lexington. And then...
Yeah, he's at UK.
UK. Yeah, he's UK. His coach has been there a year and a half or so. The next day, after he receives them, I get a phone call, and it's Rick Pitino. He goes, hey, why don't you go on a trip with us? I said, great. He said, we're going to Georgia tomorrow. Come on over to Lexington. And I said, okay. So I just told the boss, I need tomorrow off.
Wow.
So I went over and got on the plane with the Wildcats, and Pitino and I just looked at each other, and he knew that I was the odd man on. And then we've been buddies ever since.
I wondered how that started.
Yeah, he didn't know me from Adam except for the radio parodies. And then when his first book came out, or one of his books, the blue-colored one, it may have been his first book, my dad called me and he said, you're in the book! You're in Rick Pitino's book! Well, it doesn't matter what else I'd done in my life,
I was
in Rick Pitino's book. And he wrote something about, you know, how those tapes made his team laugh. He said, we were waiting on a tarmac for a plane that was delayed by mechanical issues or whatever. And he said, we just pop in one of those tapes from this guy in Louisville. And he said, it was just crack up our players because they were parroting our fans.
How about that? Wow.
It was great.
Yeah, and you've been buddies ever since.
And Pitino taught me a lesson, a very strong lesson, several years ago. And he said, you know what? You're 53 or whatever. He said, look at it realistically. You have 20 to 25 more years of being really physically able, more than likely, mm-hmm. you know, you have that much mm-hmm. time. And he said, you have to look at that as that passage is, this is a time to do your best work in life because you're smarter than you've ever been. You still have your physical capability of doing everything. This is kind of a message he gives to everybody in our age bracket.
Yeah.
And he's very good. Pitino's been so good to me about just being an encourager and also remembering to deliver that energetic punch that reminds you, don't let today, which happens to be December 30th, 2013, don't let it just evaporate without you making your mark on it emotionally. Mm, you know, love your family, tell them you love them, work hard, do your exercise, but work hard at something to achieve something. So at the end of the day, when you close your eyes, you still feel like God gave you this day and that you use it out of respect to the Lord for granting you your life, that you just didn't let it go away and just threw it away like a candy wrapper.
Interesting, yeah.
And so I think about that sometimes. Then I think, you know what? I'm now 56 years old, and I think, that's interesting. Clearly, I'm not going to live to be 112, so I'm well past my halfway mark. And as that passage narrows, I do want to make sure that I just crank the engine as hard as I can, because there'll come a time when I'm unable to swing my arms and hit a golf ball or to host a radio mm-hmm. show or to have the, you know, cognizant awareness to be able to host a talk show for 4 hours. It's hard to do.
It is. Yeah. People don't realize how much energy goes into something like
that.
Yeah.
But it was good of Pitino to do that. I mean, he's an interesting guy. He works harder than anybody I've ever known. He's just a fascinating character, and it's been a great asset in my life.
It's a compliment to you, too, though, because a lot of people who would want that from Pitino, but he knows where He knows where somebody's going to listen and pay attention and where he puts it. That's a compliment.
And I've seen him go through a real tough time too, because he messed up in his life. You know, he had a very public affair situation that wound up in the news and humiliated him. And it really, I think, helped him grow a lot too. And he says that about himself. He wasn't humble enough, and he wasn't this, and he hurt people so deeply. And it really, I think, rewired him. And so all the other people that are connected to him and in some capacity are moved to see the transition and learn from it. And if you don't learn every day that you're on this earth, you're not paying attention.
Yeah.
That's the way I feel.
It was a lesson to learn, one way or the other.
Yeah, and I'm just, my parents are gone now, and I just miss them. But I think about all the joy and the laughter and the inspiration they gave all of us. And so I think about it every day, too. Someday I always tell my parents, I know they'll be in heaven. In fact, my mom died in 2005, and it was just horrible for us, just horrible. She had aneurysms in her head. They operated on her, and she didn't live. She was in the hospital for 11 weeks. And my dad was crushed, and he'd cry. I don't think I've been a good enough person. I don't think I'm going to go to heaven. I don't think I've been good enough. I wasn't good enough to your mom. I wasn't this. I wasn't that. I said, Dad, I know you're going to be in heaven. I saw you there. I had a dream one night. It was astounding. I'm standing on a side of a road, and I've got this bag with all these papers on it, like I've got a report for some sort of severe duty or meeting or something intense. And I'm really nervous about it. And I look down the street, and it's a beautiful day. And there's my dad, and it looks like he did in his wedding picture. And he's sitting in a truck. My dad was a truck driver in real life. And it's a white car carrier truck, and there's no cars on it. And he makes a joke, I don't remember what it was, about the truck not working right. And then I look over, and there's my mom standing on the side of the road, and she looks like she did on her wedding day from pictures. And she just looks at me and smiles, and she gets in the truck and slides over on the seat. My dad puts his arm around her, and they both looked at me with this complete serenity.
Wow.
And then it was like, cross the street, you're okay. And so I crossed the street, and I walked to this building where I had to go in for some sort of intense meeting, and there were no handles on the doors. And I thought, how am I going to get in here? And all of a sudden, the door flies open, and out walks a young man past me, and then the doors open, and I went in, and then the dream ended. Well, I later realized that young man who came out was my nephew, who died when he was 20 years old, and that my parents were together.
Oh my God.
And I think I was given the vision so I could relay it to my dad. And my dad was crying in this nursing home over here right down the street at Nazareth Home.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm.
And he said, I'm not going to get into heaven. And I was able to hold my dad's hand and say, Dad, I saw you there. I saw you there. You're going to be fine. You're going to be with Mom. I saw you there.
Wow.
And it gave me some peace, and I think helped my dad. I don't know how much of it he took in at that time, but for me, it was very comforting.
You knew, yeah.
I mean, all I can tell you, Jax, I woke up from this dream, and I felt like I'd been floating. It was unlike any other feeling I'd ever had before. It was something angelic about it, something beyond the realm of the normal dreams that you have.
Interesting. Wow.
Because my mother had been gone for a year or so.
Wow.
And my dad really struggled with it. It was horrible. But all that stuff taught me again, back to square one here, get all you can out of your life. And I try to do that every day in my work. And I try to be kind to people and remember that this is a quick ride here, and you got to honor your maker for putting you here.
You know, that reminds me of something that reminds me of your humor. You are humor, and you can stick the barb in well, but you're kind with it, if that makes sense. You're not a bitter, angry person.
No.
It's funny.
Yeah.
And it stings when it needs to sting, but it's not lasting, and it's, if anybody's...
Yeah.
If they feel offended by it, they should. That's the point.
Well, I have done parodies of a lot of governors and senators and congresspeople over the years. And they're public figures.
Wilson, having you in a headlock at the back door of WHAS, the governor at the time.
Oh, did you see that for real?
Yeah.
You know what? I was walking out of the back door, and I would parody. I was the voice of Wallace Wilkinson, and I really took that voice from Mr. Haney on Green Acres. Yeah. Hey, Martha, cook up some possum pie, Martha. We're gonna sell everything we can here in the Commonwealth of Kentucky. Well, one time our ratings had slipped a little bit and DJX beat me in the afternoons. Then the next rating book came out and I was back on top. But Wallace Wilkinson was informed of that somewhere. So I walked, one night I'm walking out of the HAS building and it's an electric door. And I'm turned sideways talking, hey, yeah, I'll see you tomorrow, whatever. And I walk out the door, bam, I walked right into the governor. And he looks up and he sees me, because he's a foot shorter than I am. He looks up and he sees it's me and he turns to the state trooper and said, arrest this man. And then he grabbed me by the arm and he said, did your ratings ever get any better? He knew that. He was waiting to throw that one at me. And I was able to say, oh, I'm back in first place. Thanks for asking, Governor.
Wow. Special moments. That's something. That's wild. Well, you know, you were also in a unique position. You were sort of a bridge between the Binghams and Clear Channel. Mm-hmm. The Binghams still owned the place when you were there,
yes.
I believe, for
yes.
just a short while. Did you have any contact with them at all? Or
Yes, senior and junior. I didn't get to say much to Barry Bingham Sr., but thank you. You know, mm-hmm. I mean, he was there. Bob Morse hired me. Denny Nugent was the program director, as we noted, very creative guy.
Who was the instigator of the phone call?
Denny Nugent.
Yeah, he was a sharp programmer. He knew, yeah. But anyway, back to the Binghams,
Mr. Bingham, I just remember thanking him for, you know, letting me be a part of this. And then Barry Jr., I called a couple of times. I think he went on the air with me at least once about some nonsense. But I liked doing that in the early days. You know, you'd call the power centers, the authorities, mm-hmm. and put them on the air. Because it humanized him, first off.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But of course, I wasn't going to go out there and torque Mr. Bingham, because that's the name that signed on my check. Now, Bob Morse, who ran the whole WHAS Inc., TV and radio and AMZ, I would improve.
He was open game, yeah.
Yeah, he came in and recorded, because he did TV editorials, and then he always ended with, I'm Bob Morse. So I got him to say that for me, and then I used that all the time, and he would come in, I'm Bob Morse. And sometimes I would have him just come in.
You use that a lot. You use that a lot.
Yes. But he was cool with me parodying him. And Vin Burke was a news director who we called the Big Tuna. And he was okay with parodying, I think. He never said anything about it. But, you know, as far as governors and congressmen, I mean, Wallace Wilkinson was clearly irked by it. But, you know, what are you going to do?
Yeah.
And then it turned out when he died, he had Ponzi schemed $460 million out of people. So it's like, whatever. Yeah. Okay, I don't feel bad about it.
Now, let's talk about from the Binghams to Clear Channel, because most all of your career at HAS now has been under the Clear Channel. Years.
Right.
And you've seen some changes in that over the years, too, because when they first came in there, Clear Channel was kind of a hands-off.
Right.
They grew and that changed a lot. Can you talk about that some?
Clear Channel only owned San Antonio, their home market, and Tulsa, Oklahoma, when they bought HAS and AMZ with the Bingham family breakup. So you're talking about two stations in San Antonio, two in Tulsa, and now stations 5 and 6 are WHAS and WAMZ. So clearly the people who own the company know my name, they know Wayne Perkey, they know Jack Fox, they know everybody who works.
Two very successful stations, which provide a lot of money for them and things like that.
Exactly right. So they knew who we were. So, you know, I would get a note from Lowry Mays or whatever after
the
good
CEO
ratings.
Yeah, there,
yeah. Man. And, I mean, he's the chairman of the board, but then they started growing exponentially. And what happened is there was a Telecommunications Act in the mid-90s, and then we got into a real scuffle about the union in here, because we were owned as two stations, and then we bought 6 more, and they came in. And then all of a sudden, after union, I was a member, said, well, the guys on the 6 new stations can't do commercials on the first two, and the announcers on those new 6 stations can't come over and be announcers on these unless they get in the union, they do this or that or whatever. And then we got into this horrible squabble about that, and it really hurt my feelings a lot, because I hated to see the acrimony in the building, and that created some unrest, and Randy got mad at me, Randy Davidson, and he left, my voice guy.
He was like the union steward, I believe, wasn't he, or something?
He
like
may have been at one time. I think John Polk was at that time.
But Randy
and those are all great guys, but we just had a different philosophy about it. I would argue with them. These guys, I'm thinking of myself, too, like in Lexington when I had my mm-hmm. chance to get on. Here's these guys. They got a chance to be on HAS and AMZ. They work for these other smaller stations, but there's a brick wall. They weren't allowed to go around. Or else this thing I found illogical as well. If I walk into a booth and I record a commercial, Acme Furniture has a sale Saturday and da-da-da-da-da, and be there, it's 9 to 5, and they're selling couches for $50. That's Acme Furniture. That's the end of my job. Well, the big argument became, okay, Terry recorded that commercial, but he needs to be paid by these six other stations, even though we're going to use the same recording on his station, and on these six new stations, he needs to be paid for each one of those because they're not part of an agreement. And it was like, oh no, really, we're going to do this? And I would argue with them. I don't have to do any more work. I just recorded this. But no, the rules are the rules, and Terry, you're trying to step around the rules. And so we got into a horrible argument about all that business. And then ultimately we had a vote, and the new guys, because there were so many new guys who weren't in it, we had the numbers to just drop it. And it created a dark mark, certainly on my heart, and it changed the dynamics of the building for a while. And then also we had to move because two stations, and then when you add six more, TV owned the building, because when the Bingham sold, they had to determine who owns the building, who owns the call letters, who owns the materials, the intellectual property, all that business. They had to divide all that. Then we brought in the six new stations, and then they said, you can refurbish the downstairs, the basement. And our owners said, it's going to cost about $1.6 million to do that, to refurbish somebody else's building. Yeah. We're not going to do that. And that's when they went shopping. And Mayor Abramson had a perfect place for us on Main Street, but our management opted against it. Mayor Abramson was really hurt by that too, because he said he figured out a way to get us parking behind a building. It's somewhere, I can't remember exactly, somewhere down not far from the baseball bat factory.
Wow.
That he said had the abundant square footage and parking, and then I think it cost more than the place that we wound up buying not far from here over at Newberg Road in the Watterson. And that was an old Taylor Drugstore's headquarters, and with free parking and free whatever. And it was cheaper.
Yeah.
So Clear Channel bought that instead of staying downtown, which I thought was more important to be in a part of the business of downtown Louisville. But, you know, I didn't have a say in that. Yeah.
That was, what year was that?
99.
Okay. Been out there ever since.
Right.
I guess it's worked out all right, but there's certainly been a change in the atmosphere and the style of radio even in those years.
Indeed, because Clear Channel, you know, we had the six new stations come in and really didn't have room for them. So they sort of just rigged up these weird little, or I'm sorry, they kept the other locations wherever they were, whoever their previous owners had them, and they were paying rent because we couldn't rig up enough little odd studios in the HAS TV building. Yeah. So ultimately they had to put us all under the same roof. And I was fighting hard to keep a studio lit in the TV building and just stay there.
Yeah, right, yeah.
Because I do like the interplay of all the TV people and the interviews they get and the interviews I get, and we trade them back and forth. But I was, you know, overruled.
Has that influenced over the years? I mean, has that a big change in your style or anything? Or
Yeah, to a degree, because you just don't have... I like being in the communications center.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But really, with eight stations instead of two, you are a bigger communications center. So there is more traffic. And I do see other people that are coming in to be on other shows, and I can...
And you parody those once in a while.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I like the fact that there is some re-merging, that the law is allowing some remarrying of media properties. For instance, Gannett just bought Belo, so now the Courier-Journal and WHAS-TV are family
again. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Which before was, that'll never happen, you know.
Yeah.
Well, it will happen because you got to keep business alive.
Yeah.
I mean, what good would it do to let signals go dark? You know, if there's a way to save them, then that's what you do.
Yeah. I don't want to keep you too long, but I want to ask you about just some physical things. You've seen a lot of changes in equipment and how your product is delivered from, you know, when you were changing those tapes in Lexington to what you're doing today with the computers and a producer and all that sort of thing.
For many years, I held on to the older tapes. I just kept them in there because the computers freeze.
Yeah,
and each time the computers would freeze, and I'd go over and get my old school tapes and pop them in there and put them on the air and do whatever I need to do, and then say, I told you so.
Yeah, right.
But ultimately, Again, I was overruled, and they said, you got to get those out of there. Don't,
inevitable, yeah.
Don't like them. We don't like the look of them in your studio. So they had to go, and that's a shame. And we still run into some computer problems, although they're not as prevalent as before. What we are, though, today is more beholden to computer servers, and so oftentimes stations flip off the air, whereas before, as long as the electricity was on and you had a guy who was awake and coherent,
flip it back on.
Yeah. There was something, you know, you can stay on the air. And now, with those stations I'm talking about, we added on six stations. Well, a lot of times there's not a human being in any of those places. They're all prepackaged from somewhere else. There can be a guy sitting in Tulsa who can do all the voice drops. Hey, Louisville, you're going to have the big New Year's Eve thing at 4th Street Live. It starts at 9 o'clock. And hey, come down and see Mayor Fisher. He's going to do this. And they're handing out these banana splits. And it's going to be a good time. And join us. That's brought to you by our station, 98.9 Radio Now. Who just said that? A guy in Tulsa, Oklahoma.
Well, even your traffic reports have gone from the helicopters to, aren't they done somewhere else?
Detroit, Michigan.
Is that right, huh?
Where occasionally you'll hear a guy say, now over in Shibley, you're having a little problem.
And one of your guys always talks about Papa Level Road or something
Papa
like that.
Papa Level Road. And that happens. We're, you know, but that's, again, that is technology. And that's going on. It's not just Clear Channel. Right. They're all doing the same thing all across America.
Oh, yeah.
You got kids in Detroit watching traffic monitors in 14 different cities, and they just file reports, and then they move on to the next one. And
now, because you can. Yeah.
Now here's Memphis. Now here's Nashville. Now here's Louisville. Now here's Cincinnati.
Yeah, that's the way it is, the technology.
Yeah, and it's always fun to say it was so great in whatever era, but you can't be that way.
Well, there was an era before you who was...
Exactly right.
Saying, well, they're ruining this thing, you know, and so, yeah.
Exactly, but we can do that back through time.
Right.
Well, wasn't it better when we were all in horse and buggy, and then people got to know their neighbors a whole lot better? Yeah, I guess it was, but I can't help that. This is today, and I have to live in today with its circumstances. And to me, like we were talking about earlier, make the most of what's available to you and avoid the attitude of, oh, it was so great back then, or the way we did. Okay, but that's over. That's for storybook time and reflection time. But in terms of doing your best job in this moment, you have to be constant.
You have to keep reinventing yourself.
Yeah.
That's what you have to do.
And it's important because I think all the victories in life work through your attitude. And you take in everything you can in life through the right prism and show it positively and try to emote some positive energy back. I think it pays for it. Pays in spades. You
That's
know,
a good
it
way.
Comes back to you.
Good philosophy. Well, I think you may be in some elite company. You're probably the longest running, aside from Milton Metz, probably the longest running person who's had a continuous career on radio in Louisville, Kentucky. Is that right?
It is.
You've been on the air in Louisville in some fashion since what,
1980.
So
I am 33rd year. Yeah, I came in the fall of 1980, and I was on in Lexington for 4 years prior to that.
And there can't be too many people ahead of you in the building even there at HAS.
No, there are only two, Helen Huber and Paul Rogers.
Who we've talked to both of those on this interview series.
Oh, good.
Great. Yeah, good.
Good.
Well, Terry, I know we can talk a lot more. We could spend all afternoon. I know you've got to go get ready for a show somewhere.
Yes,
and,
sir.
It's been a pleasure, though we didn't even talk about the Derby and Crusade and all your involvement there. You've had a lot of good times there.
They're all fun. You know, I love each part of the year. They each bring a sort of a different feel to them. But to me, when I walk away from this, whenever that is, I'm at 20, coming up on 29 years completed. I have already done 29 years, haven't I? Yeah. When I walk away from all this, the crusade is the thing that matters.
Yeah.
The rest of it is all about sustenance and having fun and you know, it's light. Because our work, as you know, Jack, kind of just goes out into the air. Although I've been in airports around the world and heard your voice, so your tangible assets show up globally.
I'm watching your behavior on that moving sidewalk, so careful here.
The crusade to me is the treasure of this community because those parents come in every June and I see them and I hug them and I see the sweet children they have and they're the little angels I think were sent here to teach us a lesson. But you know, we do all we can to raise money and advance the cause of those children through services and therapy. But I always think of those moms and dads who leave there. I see how much work they have to do just to get those kids to the crusade. But then when that's over, I give them a hug and they leave. And that parent's job is
still goes on
every day.
Yeah.
Every day. And I just admire them so much. I just think how strong you are and how loving these parents and these children are, and the bond they have is so beautiful. But these moms and dads worry about what's going to happen when they're gone.
Yeah.
When they're on that sunny street that I saw my parents on, mm-hmm. what happens to their children? And that's another reason why the crusade's so great, because we're there to sort of just be the backstop and make sure that they're taken care of once mom and dad pass on.
Puts a lot of things in perspective.
And to me, that makes my career of value.
So one of the things you're most proud of, obviously.
The thing I'm most proud of.
That's great. Well, Terry, thanks for taking the time. This will be in the archives, and people from years to come will get some insights here. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Always a pleasure to spend time with you, Jack Fox.
Thanks, bud. See you later.